You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
Welcome to another edition of Cool Stuff Ride Home. Marcus Paff joined by Reggie Rizzou. On today's episode, the Devil Comet rides the dark skies. We'll explain. Oregon's Outback gains a new certification, and it's out of this world. Cheesy joke there. More in a moment. Plus, on This Week in History, a well dig yields the archaeological discovery of a lifetime. That's coming up on Cool Stuff.
Last week, we discussed the upcoming solar eclipse. Now it's been revealed that a rare comet might be visible during the event. The so-called Devil Comet, which is also known as Comet 12P Pons-Brooks, is set for a rare conjunction with the total solar eclipse on April 8th. However, as I stated, the key word here is might. The comet is set to make a flyby during that time, yet it is uncertain if the comet will be visible to the unaided eye during the day, even at the height of the eclipse. Now, this type of comet that Pons-Brooks is referred to is known as a dirty snowball, dubbed by the late Harvard astronomer Fred Whipple. Why dirty snowball? Well, it has to do with how they are formed. It is leftover bits from the universe when the planets were forming, so anything that didn't get moved into or turned into a planet, moon, or you know, some of the other bodies that were formed, kind of became a part of these comets mixed with ice. So with it being ice and rock all rolled together, you know, it's kind of like a dirty snowball. The comet has an orbital period of 71.3 years, so it isn't really a frequent visitor. It is actually designated as a Halley-type comet, a term reserved for comets that orbit the sun every 20 to 200 years. The Devil Comet was first discovered by French astronomer Jean-Louis Pons in 1812, and then again by British-American astronomer William Robert Brooks in 1883, hence its official name of 12P Pons-Brooks. It is estimated to be between 10 to 20 miles wide. On this trip around the sun, the comet had several outbursts since its first one on July 20th, 2023. Now, that first one caused its brightness to increase 100-fold. The nickname for this comet comes from the fact that the event when it had that explosive outburst from a cryovolcano on the comet's surface resulted in two streams of gas and dust emerging from it, giving the impression of two horns. That's why they're calling it the Devil Comet. Ariel Graykowski, postdoctoral fellow at the SETI Institute, said it, quote, struck all in all of us because it was so intense and produced a weird shape. As the dust and outburst expanded, it looked like the shape of the Millennium Falcon. So it went from looking for like a devil to the Millennium Falcon as it expanded out. Now, the comet's closest approach to the sun will actually be on April 21st. That is when it's going to be its brightest, and its closest approach to Earth will be on June 2nd. So while it may be possible to see the comet during the eclipse with the right gear, the best time to see it is between April 21st and June 2nd. During that range, it'll be brighter due to the heat it receives from the sun as it approaches it. They say the Devil Comet will become increasingly active and should be a captivating spectacle for those looking at it. If you could have both the eclipse and that event happening at the same time, that'd be fascinating to see. But even if you don't see it during the eclipse, I mean, stop on out during those times. It sounds like it should be an interesting sight to see in the sky.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated by stuff like this. And if I can walk outside into my backyard, look up at the nighttime sky and see it, I absolutely will. The question that I have, Reggie, is Pons-Brooks. So Pons discovered this in, what did you say, 1812? And then in 1883, Brooks sees it again. We don't typically add the second person to see something to the discovery. So why do they share credit on this comet discovery when it feels like Pond should be the guy all over this? Somehow Brooks slumped his way in there too. What, does he know somebody?
So you're telling me it should just be called 12P Pons? You know, I wonder, I guess I didn't get into the details of that when I was looking at this. I kind of wonder if it's Pond saw it, but it wasn't 100% confirmed. Brooks maybe confirmed it. Because then that would make sense that Pons said he saw something, nobody else saw it. When Brooke saw it, it became a confirmation. So you're sharing the discovery in that aspect. That's my guess of what happened. Or nepotism. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, nothing against William Robert Brooks. I'm sure he was good at whatever he did outside of seeing this comet for the second time. But it just seemed a little odd to me. Nonetheless, yes, definitely want to get out there and see this event in the nighttime sky. Like I said earlier, fascinated by everything that you can see from Earth taking place in our solar system.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Speaking of the skies of our solar system, per GNN, Oregon is now home to the world's 19th dark sky sanctuary, offering pristine views of the stars, planets, and other celestial bodies across 3,800 square miles, making it the largest of its kind. The certification was issued by Dark Sky International, a U.S.-based nonprofit founded in 1988 by astronomer David Crawford and physician and amateur astronomer Tim Hunter. Attaining said certification was no easy task in this instance either, as it involved a years-long effort by federal, state, and local officials, community members, and several legal jurisdictions. The first zone of the larger region submitted for certification comprises 2.5 million acres in southeastern Oregon. The certified area is approximately half the size of New Jersey in a region frequently referred to as the Oregon Outback. If the remainder of all areas submitted for certification are ultimately granted dark sky status, the entire area will encompass over 11.4 million acres of voluntarily protected night skies, meaning no light pollution. Get out there, look up, and you're going to see a lot of really cool stuff. Dark Sky Delegate Dawn Nilsen, who organized Oregon's application, said, quote, "As the population of Oregon and the trend of light pollution continue to rise, the unparalleled scale and quality of the Outback's dark skies will long serve as a starry refuge for people and wildlife alike," end quote. Now, I just mentioned Dark Skies International was founded in the late 80s, but the International Dark Sky Places Program was founded in 2001. That particular initiative is a non-regulatory and voluntary program designed to encourage communities, parks, and protected areas around the world to preserve and protect dark sky sites through effective lighting policies, environmentally responsible outdoor lighting, and public education. Their work has created a network of dark sky places, sanctuaries, and parks encompassing over 160,000 square kilometers in 22 countries worldwide. The Oregon Outback is remote with a sparse population and primarily comprises public lands. It's a high desert area characterized by abrupt changes in topography with sage scrub, bighorn sheep, and greater sage grouse roaming around. Now, public officials and a variety of other stakeholders participated in night sky monitoring, lighting inventories, and lighting improvements, as well as public outreach to bring the nomination together here. Phase two of said application includes portions of two other counties in Oregon. Only a few lighting retrofits and local approvals are outstanding in phase two right now, which needs to be addressed for the full application to ultimately go through, as we referenced earlier. Other famous dark sky parks in the U.S. include all of the national parks in Utah, Big Cypress National Preserve in Florida, and Big Bend National Park in Texas. So, Reg, I've never had the opportunity to go to any of these places, although living in Las Vegas, clearly the Utah National Parks would be the closest opportunity for me. So I'm going to have to take advantage of that because, as I said in story one, I find all this stuff fascinating. Would love to get up there and just have a peek to see what it's like. And I will say this, if you head due east of the city of Las Vegas to really, or I should say due west, to get away from the light pollution associated with the strip, which is plentiful, you can get far away enough to where looking up in that desert nighttime sky, it's just thousands upon thousands of light beacons, and man, is it cool.
Yeah, and that actually sounds like a great place to go look at the Devil's Comet when that time comes. I mean, because you should get a clear picture, whether using a telescope or something along those lines, to see that as it comes through. So yeah, it seems fascinating.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Taking a look at this day in history, on March 29th, 1974, local farmers digging for a well near the Chinese city of Xi'an came across one of the most interesting archaeological discoveries ever made. The discovery of a clay warrior figure soon revealed many more by state archaeologists. Zhao Kengmin, a former farmer turned archaeologist, went to the site to look at what the farmers had found. It turns out he was the perfect person to contact the farmers because a decade earlier, he found three kneeling crossbowmen, so he had an idea of what to find there. When he arrived, there were pieces of the statues all over, some as small as a fingernail. After 3 days of putting all the pieces together, he assembled two terracotta warriors. However, he didn't report his findings immediately. During that time in China, there was a cultural revolution happening, under which the Red Guards sought to destroy old traditions and ways of thinking to purify society. So he was worried that they would actually destroy the findings to kind of purify society or, you know, make them not focus on the past in ways. Well, that didn't last long, though, as a reporter came out and visited him and asked why he didn't release his findings. After begging the reporter not to publish this, the reporter still did. Luckily, the government didn't destroy the figures and instead excavated the site, finding 500 more of them. It turns out, soon after Emperor Qin Shang Huangdi took the throne in 246 BC at the age of 13, he had the tunnels and figures built and they worked on it till near the end of his rule, which resulted in his death in 210 BC. Now, there may be 8,000 terracotta figures in total, each individually modeled and purposely arranged in three pits to guard the tomb of the Chinese emperor. Remote sensing and ground-penetrating radar has revealed the whole tomb complex to be almost 38 square miles, with the unexcavated emperor's tomb at the center. Xiao was never really known for finding the statues. Instead, the farmers, who felt they were never really compensated for the find, went on to sign books and go on tours, which they got paid for. In 2004, the farmers asked to be officially listed as the ones to discover the site. Xiao was not happy about this, saying, quote, "What they want is money. Seeing doesn't mean discovering." The farmers saw the terracotta fragments, but they didn't know that they were cultural relics, and they even broke them. "It was me who stopped the damage, collected the fragments, and reconstructed the first terracotta warrior." He added that if he hadn't shown up, it, quote, "would have been a disaster," end quote. Xiao died in May 16 of 2018 at the age of 81. So, Marcus, I think this is all pretty fascinating. I would love to see these at some point. But my question for you is, who made the discovery? The farmers or the archaeologists? Was it the person who knew what it was, or the farmers who accidentally came upon it?
Well, maybe I'm naive here, but why can't you just share credit? I mean, they found them, they reported them, they brought in the expert, and the expert made the identification and, of course, let them know that this is, in fact, an item of value and something that should be taken seriously. So I guess I don't know. I mean, it's human nature. Everybody wants to be the one to have their name on something. But for crying out loud, just talk about everybody. The farmers and Zhao, they both did it together. That's my take on that. The other thing that stood out here is the guy, the emperor who had these things made, was 13? I guess I'm trying to think with my 13-year-old mind whether or not I would have wanted to carve out some figures. I suppose maybe some action figures or something at the time. Maybe he thought it was cool. Clearly a different time in history and probably a little bit more mature than I was at that age, but still kind of wild.
Oh, which is funny that you say that, because at 13, he may have thought it was cool, but then he continued on into adulthood and kept having them built. So clearly he was either really mature or he never grew up. I guess one or the other, but those would be some pretty cool action figures to play with. I don't know. But as for your point with why can't they share the credit, I do have to say Zhao never seemed to really seek the fame until they tried to, I guess, take it away from him. He stayed at the small museum that he worked at when they were found. He never moved on to a bigger or better museum. He stayed there his entire life or his entire career. And he was even fine with the farmers, you know, going out on their little book tours. He did, as people came to his small museum and see the terracotta figures that were at the museum, he said he would sign the postcards and, you know, he would do that. And he didn't really get financially compensated for that. It was more a pride thing, I think, at that point. So I think it's when they were trying to get money for it and get the discovery, I think that just frustrated him, but I'm speculating here. So I could see if you think they're just in it for the money, you get frustrated. Like if it was, we just want credit, maybe he would have been more open to that.
Yeah, that's fair. And I can see where that might cause some frustration. But at the end of the day, you, regardless of what their motivations were, they were a part of this process. So you may not like the fact that they're making money off of it, but just granting them the right to have their name on the discovery alongside yours in Zhao's case. I mean, it's really Zhao just wanted his name included once he realized that he was being cut out of the equation. I have no issue with that whatsoever. As far as the 13-year-old emperor, Mom! I told you not to interrupt me while I'm playing with my figurines!
Okay, then. Thanks for joining us on another edition of Cool Stuff Ride Home. I'm Reggie Rizzou. He's Marcus Papp. Feel free to shoot us an email at coolstuffcommute@gmail.com. You can reach out with thoughts, questions, comments. I'm not going to say whatever. also, please like us and leave a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. We'll have more cool stuff for you next week.